Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast, from Ambassador to Despot. In the wake of Sven and Zvezda's 1980 title win, a major Belgrade paper ran a post-season review of the team, and above the picture of the manager Branko Stankovic stood the headline "From Ambassador to Despot." The man who had been the rock of the Yugoslav defence in the 1950s had become one of its most successful managers, putting together the great Vojvodina side with Vujadin Boshkov that won the title in 1965-66, then winning a Greek title at AEK Athens before returning to Yugoslavia in the late 70s and, after a short return to Vojvodina, taking over at Sven and Zvezda for what would be an immensely successful four-year spell. After it, he would return for a short spell in the late 80s, one spoiled by a large falling out with a certain Dragan Stojkovic, who we'll introduce in the next episode. But in this first proper season of the 1980s, we would also see the first flare-up of nationalist expression since the Croatian Spring, as fears of a return to Rankovicism in Kosovo resulted in an uprising and, eventually, a crackdown. Yugoslavia would lurch towards despotic urges itself. Given that, however, we've just had an entire episode without mentioning football, it's only right to bring the action on the pitch to the forefront first. And unlike the previous season where Sven and Zvezda eased away with the league, this season was a far tighter affair, with a clear three-way title race. Sven and Zvezda, Hajduk, and, for the first time, Radnički Niš. The Real Staničare had been third the prior season, although with Zvezda running away with the title, they were still quite some way off ever actually challenging for the title and were level on points with another side of outsiders in Napredak Krušovac. But while Napredak would immediately fall away, ending up relegated in this 1980-81 season, Radnički Niš would continue their purple patch and, come the next season, would go on to do something rather special in what would be a short but eventful golden age for the club. This season, they would keep a challenge going right up to the 32nd round of games, where a loss to Budućnost would do for their title hopes, before they played the role of spoilers themselves on a final day where they would face second place Hajduk with Zvezda hosting Partizan. Poljud would host a wild 3-all draw on a day where Hajduk needed a win, and Sven and Zvezda would narrowly become champions once more. And just as Zvezda won their second title in a row, at the bottom of the table there was, for the second season in a row, a game that had to be postponed due to players attacking the referee. Whereas last time it was Osijek, this time the final day saw OFK host NK Zagreb, with OFK needing to win to stay up and NK needing a point to stay up. When OFK went 3-0 up in presumably suspicious circumstances, NK Zagreb players turned on the officials and Yugoslavia's febrile footballing world kicked off again. Fortunately for both sides, Borac Banja Luka lost away to Budućnost to ensure that both OFK and NK Zagreb would stay up. Coming up to replace Borac and Napredak would be Tetex Tetovo and Osijek. But the second league this season would be rocked by scandal itself, courtesy of Maribor. They would survive only on the last day of the season, but it would be found that the win on that last day was courtesy not of merit on the pitch, but in what would become known as the Zorga scandal, courtesy of Maribor's Black Fund. The club had had a bribery fund throughout the 60s until they entered the top flight at the end of that decade, which and the Black Fund itself had been re-established towards the end of the 1970s. 2 days after their final day win over Šerik to stay in the second tier, the club office was raided and documents around the Black Fund taken. Maribor had been suspected of it previously. An earlier raid saw the club tipped off about a surprise visit from the tax services to look at irregularities, and the tax man would arrive to find that the documents they were looking for were on a nice handy bonfire in front of them. Maribor's system was simple. Players had win bonuses written into their contracts, and a percentage of these bonuses would go to the referees. And the whole thing unravelled after the referee of that final day clash got drunk and spilled the beans. Maribor were ejected from the second league down into the regional leagues. When it came to the Yugoslav Cup, it served as the debut of a team about to have a renaissance, Velez Mostar. The last time we had cause to talk about Velez was a little while ago, as their original golden age gave us a grand exit with a European tie against Derby County. The generation that had propelled them to those heights with Dusan Bajovic and Sula Rebac left, and they left a solid core with a couple of very rough gems in the early stages of their career. Come 1981, those rough gems of Fahid Halilhodžić and Blaž Šišković had become some of Yugoslavia's very best players, and Velez were a firmly mid-table side, albeit a threatening one. This season would see the only ever all-Bosnian Yugoslav Cup final, as Velez faced off with Zeljezničar, who had flirted with relegation that season. It would take a late Dragan Okuka goal, after Halilhodžić, having signed a contract to move to Nantes before the game, scored a double. It gave Velez a 3-2 win and their first ever cup win under manager Milos Milutinovic. This was the season in which they also collected the Balkans Cup, if you remember that far off long forgotten tournament. This wouldn't be the massive breakthrough it could have been for Velez. Milutinovic, along with Halilhodžić, would also depart the club at the end of the season, with Milutinovic going to his previous club from playing career, Partizan. One player, however, would return that summer, Dusan Bajovic. With Enver Maric remaining in goal, two parts of the BMV would lead the club into the 80s, and later this decade would get things very right indeed. When it came to Europe, there was little of note beyond Sven Zvezda's trip to the quarterfinals of the European Cup. That would begin with an eventually convincing win over Viking Stavanger in the first round, after falling 2-0 down in the first leg before coming back late to secure that leg 3-2 on the way to a 7-3 aggregate win. The second round would see Zvezda toil against what was then a smaller nation again, firstly losing to Basel 1-0 in Switzerland, before settling things early at the Maracanã to eventually go through 2-1 on aggregate. The result was a glamour quarterfinal against Inter, and an impressive first leg 1-1 draw away at the San Siro, before an early Carlo Muraro goal, stemming from defensive and goalkeeping errors, did for Zvezda at the Maracanã. While Zvezda controlled the game, aside from one header against the bar, there was little in the way of serious imminent threat for Inter. In the UEFA Cup, Napredak fell at the first hurdle to Dinamo Dresden, perhaps unsurprisingly given that Napredak were on their way to relegation. Sarajevo fell at the first hurdle also, perhaps unsurprisingly given that they were against Hamburg, although Sarajevo did at least give the West German giants a big scare on their way to a 7-5 aggregate defeat, with Safet Susic scoring a double in Hamburg and Predrag Pasic doing the same in Sarajevo. Rednicki Niš did at least get through a round, winning both legs of their first round tie against LASK Linz, and then knocking out Beroš Stara Zagora in the second round, but after those two relatively kind draws, they were exposed by AZ Alkmaar in the third round, holding them to a 2-2 draw at Kaja, before getting hammered 5-0 in the Netherlands to the eventual runners-up of the competition that season. Dinamo Zagreb were knocked out straight away in the Cup Winners' Cup by Benfica, in an edition that would see the final played in front of under 5,000 people at the 54,000 capacity Rheinstadion in West Germany, as the final was between two eastern sides in Karlsruhe Siena of East Germany and the eventual winners Dinamo Tbilisi. Two sides who, perhaps understandably, weren't necessarily all that welcome in West Germany at the time. But the end of the season was, of course, overshadowed by events in the nation itself, as, much like Croatia a decade earlier, Kosovo flared up in unrest. Kosovo didn't have problems that were necessarily unique to the region. As one of the southern regions, as we discussed last episode, it had issues with unemployment, income, and with education. In 1981, Kosovo had both the largest amount of students and also the largest amount of illiterates of any region in Yugoslavia. One-tenth of Pristina's entire population was enrolled at its university. What was, of course, unique to Kosovo was the amount of Albanians, and also the amount of people studying what was known as Albanology, a social science that wasn't really transferable out of Kosovo for obvious reasons, and a large amount of those students were leaving university to essentially go straight into unemployment. Where the Croatian Spring came out of a nationalist movement that was acutely aware that things could be better. 1981's protests in Kosovo came out of a nationalist movement recruiting those who believed that it simply couldn't get worse. The spark that set it off was an innocuous one. Student protests in mid-March over the standard of food in the canteen at the university, but the protests swiftly grew to a couple of thousand before police intervened. The protests swiftly resumed after this initial crackdown and moved from the original narrow issue base of food at the university to a far wider and more nationalist one. As the nationalist elements in the protest escalated, so too did the force behind the police reaction, which in turn fueled further nationalist dissent at the crackdown. At this point, some of the student groups backed down, correctly seeing that a continuation of protests could see instead a return to the Rankovic era, when most of the population of Kosovo was on some kind of watch list from the intelligence services. However, by this point, things had gotten a bit out of hand. Come the 1st of April, the police alone could no longer handle the protests, with one protest resulting in 17 policemen injured, and it resulted in a move from police looking after the protests to the army doing it instead. Conspiracy theories even rose that the protests were being directed from outside, and that the Albanian security services were directing things behind the scenes. The actual demands of the protesters were fairly simple: that Kosovo be elevated to full republic status, equal to Serbia or others, but this, of course, was unacceptable to Serbia. On the 2nd of April, a state of emergency was declared in Kosovo, and 30,000 troops sent to the region to put the protests down by force. The protests would end a couple of days later. 11 had died, around 250 were injured, and around 4,000 people imprisoned. Numbers which may seem initially small, but the protests only involved around 20,000 people at their peak, meaning that 20% of everyone who participated ended up in jail. Kosovo's leadership was purged, with those sacked to be replaced by those committed to taking a hard line on Albania. The university was banned from using Albanian textbooks, and perhaps most tellingly, 280 Serbs were convicted after being caught preparing to go into Kosovo and reassert Serb identity by force in the region. The concept that Kosovo was playing host to some sort of de-Serbification suddenly grew wings in Serbia, and a new energy was given to the forces for centralisation. The debates that had been buried with the fall of Rankovic in the 60s suddenly sprouted back to life, and no sign of that would be greater than the spontaneous gatherings in praise of the life of Rankovic that would happen upon his death in 1983. Kosovo's fire was Serbia's spark. But next time on the History of Yugoslav Football Podcast, we return to the international stage for the first time for a few episodes, and Yugoslavia returns to the Olympics and to the World Cup, as we go through boycotts and more in what would be almost the last hurrah for Milan Miljanic. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to leave a review on iTunes or whichever podcast service it is you use, they are always more than welcome. And of course, sharing is caring. So I do very much appreciate everyone who listens to this. And you know, obviously, if we can expand the amount of people who do that and who become interested in football in the region, you know, that is ultimately something we'll find a great success than anything else it could possibly get from making this podcast. Thank you very much for listening again, and I will catch you next time.